businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 162 of the Killing It Podcast. Oh, Dave, it sounds like you got a sore throat there.
I might be fighting something, actually. Sharon definitely has something, and we know it's not COVID. I may be right on that edge of like, I think my body may be saying it's fighting it, but it's successfully fighting it.
I think
it,
you need to create a tipsy treat for spring colds.
Well, that would be I will pass that one on. She has them very linked to holidays for anyone who looks for our tipsy treat.
Yeah, so just for folks who are not in the know, now that I've given you the slow pitch, why don't you tell them about your other show?
Well, my wife wishes she had a cooking show, so we have one. It's called Tipsy Treats with Shaz and Dave. It's on YouTube. You are welcome to see the show that she is entirely in charge of and I show up for, where we make a cocktail, usually almost always one I have no idea what we're doing when we start filming. Comedy ensues.
Well, and the best part about it is the look on Dave's face as Sharon is describing what they're going to do. And he's like looking at the camera and kind of smirking like, God knows what's going to happen next.
Exactly. What's going to happen with this? One of my friends actually says that his favorites are the fails, when the drink is awful.
Right. Well, especially because sometimes when the drink is awful, you're like, that's like 7 ounces of alcohol. What the hell?
I will say my wife has never wasted one ever. So I may not enjoy it, but she finishes them all. But our fun question this week, gents, do you yell at the TV? Like when people are being stupid or when watching sports or both, do you yell at the TV?
I have to say I do, and I'm 98% of the time alone when I do it. So it's not like I'm sharing this experience with somebody and, you know, I'm just like hoping the neighbors are not listening.
Well, see, that's the thing. You in a karmic sense, you really hope that the people on the TV can sense your disapproval, because that's exactly why I do it. I'm not there to change anybody's mind who's in the room with me. Now, I started when I was a kid yelling at sports, and then I would, you know, yell at people on stupid things. I find, unfortunately, like in the last 15 years, I yell at the news more than I yell at everything else combined. And no, that's not going to change anything, but it makes me feel better.
I rarely yell at the TV. I mean, I want to say, you can't say no, because I have on very rare occasion yelled at the television, but it's very rare. Like, as a general rule, I am not yelling at the TV.
Much more reasonable individual.
Well, I if I have a reaction, I end up texting someone or going to one of my friends.
It's not like I have a lengthy and considered argument. It's usually something like, what the? Oh, my God, you so stupid. And then I go get a drink.
So I guess maybe yes. Well, this week we're brought to you our friends at Acronis. Are you still relying on a frustrating patchwork of legacy solutions? Modernize your cybersecurity and data protection with Acronis CyberProtect Cloud. It's a single solution that combines backup, anti-malware, and endpoint protection management. As an MSP, you can easily improve your client's security posture, eliminate complexity, and generate more recurring revenue. Learn more about Acronis CyberProtect Cloud at acronis.com.
So our first topic today, it could be very simple, but we don't do simple on this show. And I want to take a very complex view of the question, should businesses embrace or run away from social media? And obviously, you know, the news, which we've tried to not cover directly on this show, is with Elon Musk and Twitter. But more broadly, with social media, if you see this medium essentially deteriorating into chaos. And then you say, well, wait a minute, I wasn't talking about Twitter, I was talking about Facebook or Reddit, right, or something else. Should you be involved? Like, if you are a business, is it good for your business to be involved with something that is essentially unstable? And just a tiny side note, I would add that Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, so we can throw them in as well. Is it good for those businesses to be involved? Is it good for your business to be on that platform? not knowing what that platform is going to look like in 20 minutes.
All right, so I got to weigh in because I have a very bold position on this. First of all, I don't think you have a choice. I think you have to wade in to the broad online ecosystem of communities and of communications that your customers engage to. The moment you get into specific platforms, that's where it can be a yes, no, but I don't think you have a choice of you must engage. I'll observe you have two advertising platforms for most B2C realm. You've got to be on either Google Ads or Facebook Ads. You pretty much don't have a choice. You get into business, you can probably widen that some, but I will offer that when I look at the way your customers are communicating in the modern realm, you have lots of options. You do not have to be on all of them. And being on, I'm putting in those air quotes, can mean different things. You have to listen where your customers are for sure. How you choose to engage them may be different, and it may not be there, or you may find the other ones. And I also want to give a space for not all online communities are toxic and garbage. There are lots of places where the online engagement is very strong. And by the way, it can be very strong on generally toxic platforms. There are subgroups of, say, for example, Twitter, where it's a delightful place. It's about how well they have curated their feed. So you're exactly right. Like, there isn't one broad answer, but I think that one answer that is broad is, yes, you have to. You do not have a choice.
Well, and see, that's where the reasonableness of this conversation comes out. The gut reaction to any right-thinking individual is, ew, that's gross, and I don't want to have that associated with me personally, professionally, or with the brand of my organization. But the more considered analysis is, it is the modern form of communication and promotion that if you choose to cut off your nose to spite your face and just deliberately not participate, that's cool, but you've just cut off a massive form of exposure, communication, and promotion with your target audience. I think it comes down to what you're saying, Dave. There is a deliberate strategy and a way to use various platforms of social media for productive business objectives, but that does not require that you hang around and participate in the flow of sewage, right? You don't have to sink down into those conversations. You can create one-to-one communication with customers. You can either create or participate in online communities where the content is reasonable and valuable, and you can use it as a listening tool to hear what your customers are saying. I think all of those forms are valid, but it does require a conscious choice and a deliberate strategy. It's not enough to just do the social media. You got to do this thing on purpose. And just because it's free to put messages out there does not mean that social media as a tool is a free media device, because it requires much more forethought than just placing an ad on the radio.
Question to both of you, should I be careful and say, well, I will speak on LinkedIn because it's a platform that has not yet become dominated by stupidity and misinformation? Or should I be on all of them and just try to associate myself with a certain thing that fits my brand and avoid those communities that don't fit my brand? Or can you ever really disassociate when all your stuff shows up next to somebody else's stuff?
Well, there's an inherent problem in the question, which is the assumption that you get to control the messaging, right? That's a very classic marketing sales engagement model, and
well,
it's not true anymore.
I control my output. I don't control that it sits next to somebody else's output.
That's the second part of the answer, is that I believe that you as an individual and you as your brand as a company should act in a very authentic manner, and you, as long as you keep that authenticity, you act the way that you want to act. It actually is okay. You can generally find a way to do that in every medium, and I will always smile and go, because you don't have to respond to everything. not answering is always an answer.
I think that's a valid point. I think what's interesting is, if you know, all that's required for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. I think if everybody with a reasonable argument to make abandoned social media, then by definition, social media would have no reasonable opinions on it. If, however, you populate it with good and valid, authentic content, then people might actually prefer it and might seek it out and use that for the 45 minutes that they're going to spend on their screen time instead of just trolling people on Twitter, right? Like that could cause more content.
I, from time to time, post up on Facebook what I think is a lengthy and reasonable argument about something. And I get a bunch of immediate kind of thumbs up, yahoo, thanks for saying something, followed by the extremes slowly taking it over. And like, I will check it out 3 days later, they're still yelling at each other, right? And all the moderate people have shut up after the
first. But I'll offer two things. First off, you don't have to play in the comments. It literally is your feed in that case, so you can do what you want. That is your feed, right? You're the controller
right.
That's why
I say, I check in 3 days later, because I'm not responding
right.
to everybody.
And so what other people choose to waste their time on is also not my problem. I have offered my position, and I don't necessarily need to get into the scrappy bit of it. And I look at it and say, like, I'll just go concentrate on the things that actually make a difference in that. I've offered it. Here's it's useful for others. You can now take action on it. I don't need to spend a bunch of time defending it. If you don't agree with me, well, that's okay too.
Like, but to your point, Carl, it is your brand that put that thing out there. And then if it turns into a cesspool, then later on people will be like, you know, Carl says interesting things, but then the trolls come out and I really think I'm not up for that. So I'm going to avoid the things that Carl posts because they tend to be a magnet like that. You don't want that to get associated with you. So there is a certain amount of active disengagement. What I mean by that is you have to tell people that's not cool. Like, that's not what we're doing here. If you guys go way back, there was a book written, it was in 2007, called The Cult of the Amateur. And the whole concept of that was exactly what you started with, Carl. All opinions are equal, and therefore mine, even though I'm not educated, not considered, not experienced, is every bit as valid as yours with a PhD and advanced years of experience, et cetera, et cetera. Bullshit. No, it's not. That's absolutely not true. And in 2007, their use case was MySpace, by the way. And it was turning into a cesspool. And you go back and go, so quaint.
An amateur cesspool.
Well, moving right along to another area where they're full of consequences. I wanted to share an article that we saw on Vox titled, Data Breaches Happen Constantly. And the consequences are ? And I laughed, like, I wanted to do something with this on Business Attack, but I felt it was better for a discussion here, because this article felt like everything that I have been saying for the past 2 years put together in a version of it, where essentially the article walks through the, hey, there are rules and regulations around data disclosure for all 50 states at this point, and certain levels for data breach notifications. But by the way, they just keep happening, and they keep having no apparent consequences. And I just looked at this whole piece, and I said, oh, this is exactly what I've been saying. It says it so well, and I must share it. Gents, when I shared this with you, what was your reaction to this article?
Well, my first reaction was, this sounds very similar to the argument that you have made, which is that sometimes these big companies get, not data breaches, but security breaches, and it turns out that they look at it and say, oh, that's 1% of my bottom line, I don't care, and they move on, and we, the buyers of those services, don't do anything about it. It's exactly what's going on here. Raise your hand if you're in Equifax. Oh, well, that's everybody on earth. Okay. Raise your hand if you were in the Target break-in or the Marriott or whatever. I think all my data has been stolen, I don't know, 12 or 15 times this week. I think everything we do with regard to security and these data breaches is stupid and wrong. And fundamentally, here's why. the cat is out of the bag. Your data is already on the internet. I just need to go looking. It'll take me 20 minutes and $5, and I will have your social security number and your home address and all that stuff. We need to focus on making it unusable, which is why we've mentioned before, I will post my and have posted my driver's license, my credit cards on Facebook, because you can't steal my stuff, right? I've taken care of that. And you can make this unusable. You just have to go through the effort. And there's a little pain and it's a little bit difficult, but it's not expensive. And yet we treat it as if preventing the corruption or preventing the stealing of data is where it's all at. I don't think that's where anything's at. I think it's a complete waste of time.
Well, see, and I think there's two levels to where you're going, Carl. Number one, it is impossible to prevent, so you have to figure out what you will do in the case of a breach. I had a really interesting conversation in a different forum yesterday with a guy who, a deep thinker, security professional, works at Cisco, but, you know, participates in the deeper kind of industrial driving side of the way that our world is happening. And we got into a conversation about, you know, everybody in the cybersecurity world is very fascinated with zero trust and whitelisting and air gapping and creating the preventive measures that say bad things cannot come in. And he made a point. He's like, in a modern world, it is absolutely not logically valid to consider that any system is isolated. Everything is connected to everything, either electronically, digitally, or human ways, right? Like, it's the vast majority of things that go wrong are not because a hacker trumped your systems and got through all of your firewalls, et cetera, and stole your data. The reality is it's almost always human. Right? Like, I made a mistake. The guy that, you know, copied and pasted a file did it wrong. He lost his laptop or whatever. That stuff happens. There is no such thing as isolation. The only responsible way forward is to say, if and when it happens, what should I do? And there, like you're saying, Carl, there's preventive things, and then there are management things that you can do. I believe that one of the management responses, to your point, Dave, has to be consequences. I think that socially, societally, as well as economically, there ought to be some responsibility scorecards, right? Some things that say, if you didn't do your due diligence to do your part in our interconnected digital world, then either you should pay a price, or at very least you should be shunned, because it's on all of us to make this a little less shitty.
Well, and where I've been thinking about it a lot is because everyone wants there to be a single answer, right? We will increase the cost here, and that will solve the problem, right? It will go away because it is too expensive. What I actually think the solution is that you raise the cost across the board so that the cumulative cost becomes the deterrent. If you think about it the way you're spending in a budget situation, right? Like when you start comparing things, it's not the one single choice to add on the new feature to the car. It's the fact that when I check all the check boxes, all of a sudden I get to the end and the total MSRP is too high. And so I have to, so I make new decisions because it's too expensive. This is the same thing. Everywhere along the line, it needs to be add up so that the end result is so expensive that it doesn't happen at the same level, both on the attacker front and on the data collector side. Then when I think about it, if I think about it from an attacker perspective, I want it to be so cumulatively difficult that it is damaging to their business. Not because there's any one thing, but when you add up, well, the fines are really high, and now the fact that I might go to jail, and that there's this expense and that expense, and you drive it up, that's one side. And on the data collection side, it's the same thing. Well, if I collect too much data, that's one thing. And if it's released at this size, and it's released to this wide scope, and if you just all of a sudden the cumulative level becomes too high, it will make smarter decisions. Because remember, the best choice is to not have the data to be leaked. if you are much more deliberate about the investments, you know you have to collect some, so you are much more deliberate about what I take on to try and reduce my cost.
Yeah, it's almost like an analogy to the minimal viable product, right? How little data can you collect and get your job done? I do have to say, I think most of the issue should be on the what do you make the data unusable side. But in terms of prevention, a lot of places ask for things that they just don't need. I remember registering my daughter for sixth grade, and they had one of the questions was social security number. And I'm like, are you paying my daughter? Why do you need her social security number? And I just refused to give it to them, and they let her go to school anyway. It turns out they don't actually need her social security number for her to go to school. Right? So, you know, we can limit how we collect it. And I think that's one of the good things that's being done. But I think the rest of it is just spending our energy in the wrong direction.
Well, and see, I think you're correct there. There are ways that you can minimize your own exposure, but there has to be the backside of that that says, if you collect it and you do not treat it responsibly, that's on you, and we're all going to extract a price. The problem is that requires consumers to do things that are new and different, and most of the time we're a little bit lazy and we don't do that. I've been like you, Carl. I've been caught up in like all these credit card exposures and all the, you know, Target stores and all these things. And did that affect my behavior? Sometimes, right? Like sometimes I said, I don't want to use that credit card company anymore. You are clearly a problem, and therefore I chose a different credit card company. Did I stop shopping at the same retail stores? No, I actually still go to that store. So, you know, it's on us to extract the economic pain that they will then choose to be more responsible. Until that happens, nobody's changing.
Just like viruses, I mean, this people become numb to this. Oh yeah, my data's been stolen. You know, like I'm sure it's been stolen by Kohl's and Penny's and, you know, Forever 21, and right. So they just like they do nothing different. So
no, they're not going to. So we're gonna move on to a different topic here, gentlemen, where we might actually be able to make a difference. But I say might in very capital letters. So our third topic is going to be focused on the continuing evolving way of working in our world, right? The new normal, to really scratch the chalkboard there for Carl. We're going to talk about the new normal of employment. And specifically, we're referring to a piece of research that was done by ADP, the payroll folks. They do a lot of global research with some very, very large sample sets to get a picture of what's going on. And one of the headlines that we're pointing to here says, if you require people to come back to the office full time, will that have an impact on loyalty and longevity and job satisfaction? And what their data shows is, yeah, it will. And this is going to have not only, you know, some continuing problems in the very tight recruiting market that we're living in, but also the way that we work inside of our own organization. So this is a very broad topic. I want to put it out to you guys and just kind of see, in the new way of working and employing people, is it a valid risk to say, damn it, we're just going to go back and do it the way we used to do it and require everybody to come to the office, no changes for our business? Or what's the alternative strategy?
I'm shocked, I say, by this data. It was completely. So I'll plug a little bit on this, that I've got an interview coming out on the Business of Tech with the author of Running Remote. I actually know that I've taken some criticism from my own listeners a little bit, that I'm very focused on this particular topic. And so I wanted to re-examine it to sort of say, like, am I right? Am I right in thinking that there's a big opportunity here? And I will sort of smile and go, yeah, I think I'm right. And I got some validation on that. But where it was interesting is that it's exactly this thinking of, I will manage it based on time and I will manage it based on absolute. There's a lot more transformation that organizations need to do in order to be effective at being a remote organization. And it is not simply a decision about, am I in the office? Am I out of the office? That's misses the point. There's actually managerial changes, there's process changes, there's culture changes, there's a lot to this. And this author talked about panic remote workers, the people that were forced into it due to the pandemic versus those that have made deliberate decisions to be remote workers, and that they are actually two groups of people, and that you have to understand the differences, and those in the new group are not learning necessarily the proper, you know, quote unquote proper, the most effective ways of being, you know, of using a remote world. And for me, it's this element of, we're sort of trying to poke at this absolute, and most of the surveys come around on this, well, what would happen if you're fully remote? What would happen if you're 3 days remote? What if you're happening in one day? And it's like, that's the wrong question, everybody. The right question is, how do I manage measurement of results, managing people, culture in an organization? Oh, and by the way, the reason I'm so fixated on this is that's really hard, and that's what consultants are really good at helping with. That's why I like it, because we all make money helping orgs get better at it.
Well, one of the reasons I like this topic is that I think we will be talking about this for a good solid 5 years, if not longer. I think we're just at a transition point where people are realizing that there are different kinds of work. And this is, it's kind of like a 20-sided, one of those silly dice that hippies play with. That, you know, the topic can include age of the worker. It can include whether you're a knowledge worker or a manufacturing worker, whatever, and as well as building your culture, worrying about your career. I mean, there's so much great research coming out of this in terms of, hey, if you're the one who actually shows up in the office, is this going to be better for your career 5 years from now? If you're the one who insists on being remote, is it going to be good for your career or bad for your career? We've talked on this show about managers who can't figure out how to actually manage people, so they end up measuring how much their eyes move during the day, right? There's stupidity as well as some serious stuff. I think we need to just figure out, if you could do a zero sum, what would this job be like? How much does it need to be in person? How much needs to be remote? Some of that has to do with your career. Some of it has to do with socialization and culture. Some of it has to do with profit. Oh, wait, we haven't even talked about that yet, right? So there's many, many sides to this. And I just love that there's so much good research. One of these articles actually points to two other articles I'm not going to hyperlink. I'm just going to mention them because the titles are so good. You know, if you think that your office is going to be filled with people, you're about to be very sadly disappointed, right? So I like the topic. I like the complexity of the conversation. And I do think the answer will be different in 5 years than it is today, because everybody's going to be 5 years older, and the society will have evolved, and the economy will have evolved.
Well, and the underlying attitude about what is work will have evolved. I think that's exactly the right way to look at it, Carl. It's not a question of can you, but can you do it well? Right? It's not a question of should we do it this way or should we do it that way. I believe that what we've entered is a fundamentally new way of thinking about the world of work, in which location is not a physical requirement, right? Up until now, that was an isolated, very rare thing, right? The three of us all work remote, and we have for a long time, and we think it's normal and have thought that for a long time. But we were incredibly rare up until 2 years ago. If you do the actual math on the population, those who work either primarily or exclusively remote from their employer or from their clients, up until 2019, that represented less than 2% of the total working world. And now it represents something dramatically more than that. Now, having been in that situation for more than 20 years, and then looking at the rest of the world come crashing into this new mindset, there is a lot of hard learning that needs to go on. My main takeaway from it right now is that being a locationless organization is a skill, and like most skills, most people suck at it. Most organizations have not done the hard work to do what you're talking, Dave, to talk about re-engineering business processes and designing communication and collaboration capabilities so that whether you are in the office or remote, it doesn't matter, right? And then how do you manage culture in or out of the office? Both of them can be done. I think that this is a permanent phenomenon. And while I do believe that this data point in here that says 64% of the people said, if you told me I had to come back full time, I'd quit and get a new job. We all say a lot of things in surveys that we don't actually follow through on. But if it's not 64%, it's radically more than 2%. And that's where people need to.
Right. It's a number that matters.
I would also say that one of the other variables that we haven't touched on yet is, what if this is your first job? Like, since 2019, you may have taken your first job in 2020, 2021, 2022, in which case you don't know what the real world is like, and how you may not have this option to decide what your boss is going to pay you and how they're going to structure the organization and so forth. That's not normally a variable that's left up to the new employee.
Exactly. And the one thing that I will say, right, I've been recently doing a ton of deep research into this topic, and we've put together a series of workshops on building a business practice around collaboration as the technical platform, and then on top of that, the business consulting that goes with it. And what I will say is, the tools and the technologies are phenomenally more capable than they were even just 2 years ago. It's remarkable how well you can work from anywhere if you know how.
Oh, and how to do it right. And that's not necessarily a technology question, it's a business process question, which is why I like it. But I think that is probably the way we're going to run out of time.
Exactly. And we are out of time, but we will revisit this topic. So we're going to put it in a little box right next to the burrito delivery robot, and we will visit it once again in the future. But for now, that will do it for episode 162 of the Killing It Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It Podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.